From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
The U.S. Senator Dick Durbin, the Democratic whip in the Senate, has announced he will not seek another term. That move sets up a scramble to replace him starting in 2027. We'll discuss that and look back at Durbin's career coming up here on State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield, and our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, Professor Emeritus and former Director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Charlie's also been a longtime reporter and observer. And our guest this week is Dave McKinney. He's a reporter with public radio station WBEZ in Chicago. Dave, always good to have you back with us.
Oh, Sean, thanks for having me.
So this has been a closely watched decision, months in coming. I think we were talking about this even a couple of years ago. Finally, Dick Durbin has announced he will not seek another term. Now, he is 80 years old. He still has not quite 2 years left on his current term before he would be out of office. Dave, you talk with him. Was age a factor in his decision?
Yeah, I think that he pretty much built this entirely around his age. By the time a sixth term would finish, Durbin would be 88 years old. And while he pointed to examples in the Senate of people like Bernie Sanders and Chuck Grassley from Iowa, people who are older than him and who are still highly functioning, he's worried that, there are plenty of other examples where people, become completely kind of incapacitated based on age. I mean, he didn't mention her by name, but Dianne Feinstein comes to mind. And of course, everybody saw what happened to Joe Biden in the presidential race. So I think this is now, Durbin has reached a point where, he's had, some minor health problems that we all get as we age, knee replacement, hip replacement, but he's still sharp and physically able to get around. But he just is kind of at the point now where I think he wants to enjoy a little bit of retirement and get out while he's still, in control of everything.
Yeah, Charlie, I mean, he's, is he slowed down a bit? Maybe he has a bit. Everybody does at some point. But Dick Durbin has always struck me as extremely sharp. You may not like his politics, but you have to realize, I mean, he is certainly playing a very political role for the Democrats, and he has seemed, up to the fight throughout all the months that I've watched him here in this term. So what do you think about the decision here, Charlie?
Well, I think it was probably to be expected. One of the things that people were pointing to was the fact that he was really lagging behind in terms of fundraising, that he basically had raised not a whole lot of money, virtually no money, getting ready for a presumed run for reelection. And so the thinking was, yeah, he's probably going to retire. And there was also criticism from unexpected quarters. And I think, Dave, you wrote about this. When Durbin helped provide the votes for the Republicans' tax package to move through the Senate, he got criticized by groups including the Chicago Federation of Labor, a Personal PAC, Equality Illinois, and other groups that would be in his corner normally and would not be talking out like that, that they were very disappointed in him for voting for this continuing budget resolution to keep the federal government from shutting down. And his explanation was that a shutdown would have plunged the country into chaos and turmoil. And he later met with these groups to explain his vote. And part of it, there's also been a lot of talk among younger people that it's time for these senior citizens to step aside and let a new crew take over. Now, in the honest and interest of full disclosure, I happen to be older than Dick Durbin by 3+ years. And so I don't think I would be ready to be a U.S. senator. Not that I ever would have been. But yeah, so you reach a point where you realize that it's time to step aside and let younger people come in and move the ball forward.
Yeah, Dave, did he talk about this to you a lot? Or did he say that weighed in any of his decision as far as some of the criticism he'd been getting just recently?
No, I mean, he stood clear of the criticism part of it pretty much. I mean, he did talk a lot about, his sort of, deep concern about the direction of the country right now under Donald Trump, and not really clear about how some of these constitutional challenges that Trump is making, how it's going to affect the country. I mean, he was very, very worried about the where the country is at right now. And he said that if there was one thing that kind of was counterbalancing his worries about his age, it would be that, because he's sort of leaving at this existential moment when there are these questions about can American democracy, that what we've known for 250 years, can it survive in the form it's in right now? And he said that that would be one thing that was the one thing weighing heavily on his mind as he made this decision.
So let me ask on that criticism part from, and it's mostly coming from a progressive wing of the party, as Charlie mentioned, some younger folks as well. This reminds me to some extent of what we have seen in recent years in the Republican Party. The establishment is out, so to speak, and people want different voices in there. They want to go a different direction. Does that seem what's happening with the Democrats right now, that maybe there is a movement underway?
Yeah, I think it's a legitimate question about whether there is this restlessness on the far left flank of the Democratic Party. You see it in other states. Chuck Schumer has had to fight it off, and with the Republicans, it kind of almost dates back to the Tea Party movement, where that group sort of coalesced and kept kind of building momentum and morphed into the MAGA movement. And it almost seems like the Democrats are kind of cooking up their own version of kind of a core group that is going to become more and more, could become more and more of a force in primaries. So I think I don't, again, I don't know that in a case like Durbin, I don't think he would have had any major issues getting out of a primary if anybody had contemplated running against him. I mean, because that's just it. There was no organized effort at all that I'm aware of to put somebody up against Durbin should he choose to run for a sixth term. I think he would have probably won a sixth term, but it's a legitimate thing, a big issue right now for the Democratic Party for sure.
Yeah, what do you think about that, Charlie? I mean, you've seen these movements come and go in both parties through the years. Sometimes they're a little more conservative, sometimes they're more moderate on the Republican side, sometimes a little more moderate on the Dems, sometimes a little more progressive. But definitely seems like something's happening here right now. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, and I think a lot of it has to do with age. And I think I read somewhere there's oh, maybe half a dozen U.S. senators who are 80 plus who are not running for re-election. And there's the notion that the younger people are kind of chomping at the bit and they want their turn. And they say that you old guys have messed it up, and now it's our turn to try and set it right. And so I think that the names that have been mentioned as possible replacements for Senator Durbin, they're all pretty much young enough to be his kids. And so you realize that that's part of it. There's the desire to have younger blood in there and people who've been waiting their turn. And they're saying, why don't you old guys get out of there? Because it's now our turn. And people, particularly among the progressives, may say, the old guys have messed it up. Now give us a chance to set things straight.
And it seems to me, Dave, this could be maybe that's the right strategy. I've talked to some people who feel it is, and then I've talked to others who say, no, maybe we've gotten a little too progressive at times, and that's what has allowed Donald Trump to be in office. So, the old go woke, go broke type thing. So really, they've got some big decisions to make. But when it comes to the possible replacements for Dick Durbin, people on the Democratic side who want to run, it didn't take long for the Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton to come out basically the very next morning and announce that she was going to run for the office. She's been raising money and going in this direction anyway. And now she has, as of Friday morning, the endorsement of J.B. Pritzker. So has to be, that's a pretty big coup for her, I would think.
Well, I mean, it provides, a very clear picture of how she can fund her campaign. I mean, that gives her an advantage over pretty much the entire field, I would say, except for another potential candidate, Northwest Suburban Chicago Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy. I mean, he's amassed $19 million, a very prolific fundraiser. But for the most part, all of these folks that are being identified as people that may want to succeed Durbin, now you have to look at Stratton as as somebody who would be able to tap into Pritzker's vast financial resources.
And also, we've heard from Mike Frerichs may be considering a run. The state treasurer, Congresswoman Robin Kelly, Congresswoman Lauren Underwood have all been mentioned as well. Any of them right now, like you said, Juliana Stratton, I still don't think most people know who she is because lieutenant governor is not that prominent of a position. So does anybody have an advantage? I'm guessing that Stratton may be because of the Pritzker endorsement then.
Well, I mean, you have to kind of wonder if, if Pritzker himself seeks re-election. I mean, the groups that always are trying to curry favor with the governor, labor, the lawyers, the traditional Democratic constituencies, will they just sort of gravitate toward her? But, like you say, I mean, it's a very unusual thing for a lieutenant governor in a kind of a lesser known role in state government to be able to make the big leap to U.S. Senate. It's just hard from these other statewide offices that we have. I mean, you can think of Alexei Janulis a few years ago. He tried to run for Senate from state treasurer. It didn't work out. And go back to Durbin's year, 1996, when he was first elected. On the Republican side, you had a very similar situation where then Governor Jim Edgar threw his support to his running mate, Lieutenant Governor Bob Custra, and then Custra never got out of the primary. But in this case, Durbin says that he's aware of at least a dozen people who are serious candidates who might have an interest in going the next step here. And he's had people, those folks that you mentioned there, at various times had called him. Just kind of wondering what his intentions were. I mean, he got a phone call from former Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel, although Emanuel, I don't think is he hasn't shown his cards yet as to whether he would do this. He's been mentioned, of course, as a presidential contender potentially in the next cycle. But yeah, it's going to be a free-for-all here. And I think it's going to be a battle, as these things always are, for TV and digital ads and reaching people that way. But it's going to be one of the widest open U.S. Senate races we've seen here probably in 30 years.
Yeah, Charlie, it's coveted to be a U.S. senator. I think everybody that's in the House pretty much is always looking, are you going to move up and run for the U.S. Senate? They don't always open up that often. I mean, Tammy Duckworth's in, no thought that she may be leaving anytime soon. So this could be one of those rare opportunities for somebody to make that move. It's not uncommon to see a ton of people showing their interest in this, I think.
Yeah, and that's true. And one of the considerations, for example, for Krishnamoorthy, Lauren Underwood, Robin Kelly, other current U.S. reps who have been mentioned as potential Senate candidates, they have to decide, am I going to get involved in a primary to run for Senate and give up my House seat? Because they are in districts where they're pretty much guaranteed re-election if they stay in the House. But if they all three run in the primary, two of them for sure are going to be out of jobs. So that's got to be consideration for them as they're thinking about moving ahead.
We're talking about Democrats here. Republicans also may see an opportunity, thinking that, okay, Durbin has been very entrenched. Maybe somebody new without as much name ID might be susceptible to being defeated. And it hasn't been that long ago that Illinois had a Republican U.S. Senator. It was Mark Kirk. There's some names already being floated out there, among them a sitting congressman, Darren LaHood, from Peoria, the son of Ray LaHood, who was a longtime congressman and U.S. Transportation Secretary under Obama. So Republicans have a shot here, do you think?
I would guess that it would be an extremely long shot. And the reason is because Illinois has become a much more Democratic state. Part of it has to do with demographics. Part of it has to do with the changing landscape. Downstate is basically solidly Republican, with the exception of some of the major cities and some of the college towns. The city and the suburbs are pretty solidly Democratic, and the population is in the city and the suburbs. And so a Republican, particularly a Republican from Central Illinois, who is not very well known, would have a real tough row to hoe. And so I don't think, doesn't matter who the Republican candidate is, I would be very surprised if that Republican were to win the U.S. Senate seat, because Illinois has changed dramatically since Mark Kirk was the U.S. Senator 20 some years ago.
Your thoughts on that, Dave? Do you think a Republican could pull an upset here?
Well, it kind of goes back to the question about who's controlling in both these parties, who's controlling the primary election. And you have to figure that the MAGA base is going to be the one that kind of dictates in Illinois who the nominee would be. And LaHood has I think LaHood is on pretty friendly terms with Trump. And so from that aspect, he comes into this with an advantage within his party. But then, you look at somebody that, say, for example, an Adam Kinzinger. An Adam Kinzinger would be, I think, a formidable candidate for U.S. Senate in Illinois, and might do well in a general election. But Kinzinger's problem would be he probably would not get out of a Republican primary because he's such a strident Trump critic. And so therein lies the problem for the Republicans. I mean, you look back at Kirk. I mean, he left office, I believe, in 2017. You look back at these examples. I mean, Rauner, Jim Edgar, the template for winning Republican candidates statewide in Illinois are these candidates who are fiscally conservative and socially moderate. And because the primary vote is the way it is now, it kind of demands that these candidates hew farther and farther to the right. It makes it harder for them to win in general elections. And so I think that's the struggle for Republicans in this race. I mean, LaHood is a name that I think people do recognize, and he's a personable guy, and he's operated without scandal there, but I think that he's got a big uphill struggle because the Republican Party in Illinois has just the infrastructure is it feels like it's been broken for decades because there was a time, of course, when Republicans controlled the executive mansion for, Charlie, correct me if I'm wrong, was it 26 straight years? And those days are long since gone when they had that get out the vote operation that was so reliable and would win election after election. Now it's a much bigger struggle, a grassroots struggle, but they just don't have the infrastructure.
I just want to return. Let me return to Durbin here for just a few minutes before we wrap this up. Dave, you talked to him about some of what he viewed his accomplishments were in the since he's been in office. What did he point out?
Well, I mean, it's something that a lot of people today have long since forgotten, but back in 1987, he was a member of the U.S. House, and Durbin filed a bill that would ban smoking on airlines. And I don't know how many folks out there remember being able to go on a commercial airline, and they had a no smoking section in the on the plane, but of course it didn't have any effect because the smoke would waft up into other areas of the cabin. Durbin wanted to get rid of that. Durbin, his father died at a very early, in his early 50s, and he was a two-pack-a-day Camel smoker. Durbin was at his bedside when he died, and it had a very profound effect on him, watching his father die, really a preventable death because of smoking. And so he points to that struggle to get that bill passed. The tobacco industry in Congress and all the state houses held enormous sway back then, and getting a bill like that passed took a heavy lift, and he wound up getting it passed. And the reason it was significant is because then it opened the door to at least to raise the question, well, if it's not okay to smoke in an airplane, why is it okay to smoke in a bus or on a train or in a public building or in a school? And that created this just domino effect where we now are at a point where, you know, anytime you see smokers, they're always standing outside. They're not smoking indoors typically. So that is what he pointed to as most significant legislative achievement.
And Charlie, what do you remember the most about Durbin during his time in office, whether as legislation or something else?
Well, I think he was a very instrumental also in trying to create, as Dave pointed out in his story, trying to provide safeguards for undocumented youngsters who were brought, or people who were brought to the U.S. as children, to protect them from deportation. And he started in 2001, and it wasn't until 2012, under President Barack Obama, that the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, that it became reality. And what that program said was that if you came here as undocumented child, you were protected from deportation. And so that's, I think, is something very much to his credit. He's also, in part because of his position on the Senate Appropriations Committee, he's brought a ton of money to Illinois for a whole variety of projects.
Let me just take a couple of minutes to also mention we finally found out what the outcome of a trial against a sitting state senator was this week. That is Emil Jones III. He's the son of the former Illinois Senate President Emil Jones Jr. And a jury this week deadlocked in this case against him. It was a bribery case that was brought against Jones. Dave, fill us in just quickly on this case, what it was all about, and what the outcome means now.
Well, I mean, the allegation just quickly involved, an issue where a former executive of a red light camera company had was pushing legislation that Emil Jones III had a hand in the Senate. It was basically there was a bill that was that he had that was going to do a statewide study on the effects of these red light cameras. And the industry itself, I think, was very wary of what that might show. And so this executive was keen on having Chicago stripped out of Jones's bill. And Jones was amenable to that. And prosecutors say that this executive, this former executive, offered Jones $5,000, and then also offered to hire a former intern of Jones's to and the feds built this case around the idea of Jones running legislation that was favorable to this industry, at the same time, being offered this money, and then work for the former intern. And the case fell apart. The jury deadlocked on all three counts, and a mistrial was called. And it's another blow for the federal government here in some of these high profile corruption cases they've been taking on. The government has not said whether they'll seek a retrial of Jones, but for Jones, for the moment, aside from all the attorney's bills that he's had to pay, this means that for the short term anyway, he won't be going to federal prison.
Yeah, and he stays in office right now. Charlie, I'll let you weigh in. I know you've been following this case as well.
Yeah, I think part of the difficulty and it was never clear to me whether Jones himself initiated any of this or whether it was the red light camera guy. And in some of the testimony, at least what I read, it appeared as though the government mole was leading Jones on, prompting him and asking him to say, well, what would be a number? What should I give you? That kind of stuff. So the jurors maybe thought, well, this is not so much Jones being corrupt as it is the federal government trying to entrap him. And it was pretty clear that the jurors were sharply divided, and they deliberated for something like 23 hours over 4 days, and then they finally came up and told the judge, look, we can't come to an agreement on any of these three counts. And so there was a mistrial declared, and now I think that they're going to come back, I believe, in June to see what happens next.
All right. Let's go down to our notes from the field. Charlie, we'll stay with you on this one.
Sticking with Dick Durbin, interestingly enough, the first time he ran for the U.S. House of Representatives in 1982, he won by 1,400 votes over Paul Finley, who was a longtime U.S. representative from this area, but he did not carry Sangamon County. He lost Sangamon County by roughly 1,300 votes. Then when he ran for the Senate and he successfully won in 1996, he also didn't carry Sangamon County. He lost by roughly 1,100 votes. And I think, Dave, was it in your story where he pointed out that Abraham Lincoln had the same problem, that he wasn't able to win in his home territory?
Yeah, definitely.
And then another interesting thing I thought, and this is, I don't know if it's a harbinger of bad times ahead, but Illinois has confirmed its first case of measles. And this occurred in an adult in far southern Illinois who went into one of the local health clinics and they tested him and it came back positive for measles. And so that's the first measles case this year in Illinois. And of course, there's a nationwide outbreak going on.
And Dave.
Yeah, I would turn back to another little anecdote from Durbin as well that caught my ear. You know, in kind of researching his past, I stumbled upon a speech that he delivered on the House floor. I think it was in 1989, and it was kind of a farce, but it was an entertaining minute-long speech in defense of the wooden baseball bat, because Major League Baseball at that point in time, there was talk about would they let aluminum bats in. And so Durbin and I, as we were talking, we're talking about baseball, and he told me this story about how he helped Stan Musial, the former Hall of Fame St. Louis Cardinals great, get a Presidential Medal of Freedom under President Barack Obama. And Musial went to the White House, got the medal put on him, and it got coverage. And a short time later, after the whole thing happened, Durbin said he got a phone call, and he answers the phone, and it's Senator Durbin. This is Ernie Banks, and the Hall of Fame Cubs shortstop at that point was like, hey, I saw that Stan Musial got this presidential medal. How do I get one? And Durbin said, let me work on it. And within, you know, another, I don't know, year or so period of time, Ernie Banks got his Presidential Medal of Freedom as well. So, you know, Durbin is a big baseball fan. He grew up a St. Louis Cardinals fan, goes to Wrigley Field all the time. And so he helped a couple of Hall of Famers get Presidential Medals of Freedom. So that was kind of an interesting anecdote he told.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have for this episode of State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler and WBEZ's Dave McKinney. Look for State Week where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Join us next time.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.